Hello and welcome to the Rogers Brief for April 6th, 2024. I'm Adam Rogers. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Well, I took the week off last week for Easter weekend. Played some hockey, had some chocolate and all that good stuff. So some of the stories and some of what I'm going to discuss this week, actually particularly the last one, the Mass Casualty Commission update, I guess 1 year on, that'll cover some things that happened about a little over a week ago, especially with the RCMP release from their reaction to the Mass Casualty Commission report. But I'm going to start off with a few other national stories and a case from Alberta, which I think will have certainly national implications and is part of the national criminal law policy discussions. So the story I'm going to talk about is first the foreign interference inquiry. It's taking place now in Ottawa with Commissioner Quebec Justice Marie-Josée Hogue. I'm going to talk about the Online Harms Act. This is starting to make its way through. Has not yet started debate on this in Parliament, but it has lots of debate outside of Parliament. Listen to an interview with the Justice Minister just today, actually, on this, on the proposed Online Harms Act, and so I have some reactions to some thoughts on that. The case I'm talking about is out of Calgary, and it is a medical assistance in dying case. And it's one of these things, so I'm generally speaking a supporter, wouldn't say proponent, but a supporter of there being a regime in place for medical assistance in dying. In many cases, I think it's completely appropriate. People want it. It's, you know, part of an individualistic, freedom-oriented approach to justice and to these kind of decisions. In a sense, this case is going to cause some people pause. It means it's one that I have some questions about too, so I'll get into that a little bit. And then talk finally at the end about the Mass Casualty Commission report. 1 year later, where are we? Who's talking about it? What are they saying? Notice actually just as I was coming in to prepare for this, make some notes, going through the news, I see Cameron Ortis. I talked about him a number of times, convicted of national security breaches, has been granted bail pending appeal. So that's interesting. Not so much that he's appealing the decision and the sentence, certainly, I think it was 14 years or something, but that he's received bail pending appeal. So as part of the test for bail pending appeal, you have to show that you have some hope, some basis for your appeal. And it's not just the fact that you filed the documentation, that there is some foundation to it. So interesting that the Court of Appeal felt that there was at least that much of him not being perhaps, well, somebody with that kind of skill set, I guess, is always somewhat of a flight risk, but they didn't talk about the conditions in the news article I read, but I'm sure they're quite strict. All right, let's get into it. Foreign interference inquiry. Been in the news a lot this week with some testimony from former Liberal MP, now independent Han Dong, as well as former Conservative leader and MP Aaron O'Toole. Others testified as well, including the head of the Security and Intelligence Threats to Election Task Force. So this was under some focus this week. This was the task force set up before the last election by the government that was made up of senior civil servants with knowledge of, you know, security issues, potential threats to the election integrity. And they were set up to monitor that. And I thought at the time, I think the public thought at the time, that if they were to discover something, that they would report that to the parties, the people involved, to the public. They didn't. They had the intelligence that there were, attempts by the Chinese government, were the examples given this week, to affect the election. Some of what we heard this week from Aaron O'Toole talked about the misinformation coming from Chinese government-aligned sources. With Han Dong, we heard testimony of a busload of students, people that weren't Canadian citizens voting at the nomination meeting that he had. And then Han Dong later on being implicated, and he didn't really deny making a comment to Chinese government officials not to release the two Michaels at a sensitive time in the Canadian electoral cycle. So some things there, some notable things. So all of this is notable in one way, which a number of ways, but one common way, which is probably would not have received this information, there's certainly this level of detail under the process originally proposed by the government, the David Johnston Special Rapporteur process. There were many security documents this week released that would not have fit the mandate of the Johnston Inquiry Special Rapporteur. But now, because it's a judge with the powers and authority of a justice of the Superior Court, that can be ordered disclosed. The other thing that came out this week was the two Michaels comment from Han Dong. That had been reviewed by David Johnston and essentially cleared, like he didn't do it. Well, Han Dong's testimony this week was not so clear at all. Like, he himself was basically saying, yeah, I kind of did say that to the government not to do it. So quite different there. Han Dong didn't have a good week. He was testifying and then unveiled in his testimony that he suddenly remembered this busload of Chinese students showing up at his nomination meeting. He didn't know any of them. They were from a school that were at the edge of a district, his district. They just showed up to vote for him all of a sudden, and there he was. And so he didn't reveal any of this early on. Hadn't, you know, he's like, oh, I just remembered. Well, peculiar thing to just remember, and not very credible testimony on his part. So, interesting week. The main takeaway for me from all this is this Security and Intelligence Threats to Elections Task Force site. That needs to be reformed before the next election. If they are, so all three main parties had their campaign managers, officials there saying they were not told any of this. The head of the task force said, well, we were just supposed to make them aware of generally how foreign entities try to attack elections, and then you parties, you use your own resources to see if you can find it. Well, that doesn't make sense. If you have the information, you have the intelligence, you should provide it to the parties that are most affected. So that certainly needs a mandate reform, if not an overhaul. Okay. Follow the testimony in this. We're going to have some high-profile testimony coming from the Prime Minister and folks around the government, so we'll be certainly paying attention to that. Next story, the Online Harms Act. So I was listening to Justice Minister Varani on the Toronto Star's podcast, It's Political with Athea Raj, who's on the CBC At Issue panel as well. So he was talking about the Online Harms Act and the two sides of it. People would know following this by now, there's sort of two parts to the bill. This was an interesting part of the interview. By the way, the Justice Minister was very standoffish in this interview, in his answers. A lot of not accepting the premise of your question kind of responses. Well, I don't accept that. Like, that there's been critiques of the online. Like, has he not been watching the news? He must know that there are many critiques of the Online Harms Act, which has not even come up for debate yet in Parliament. But there's two parts, really. One is sort of protection of children, protection of people from non-consensual intimate images being shared online. Great. Everybody's in support of that. Even people who would normally sort of be reflexively opposed to any kind of online regulation are saying, all right, yes, okay, that makes sense. The second part, though, is the criminalization of hate speech. extra criminalization of, I guess, in a sense, or the approach to it that they're taking. First of all, it's just the problem of this government, because of being this government, that people don't exactly trust them to regulate speech. Online hate speech content. They're trying to set up this new sort of entity of that would do the regulation, but they're also making changes to the Human Rights Act and to criminal code that would allow things like P-spawns, which are in advance prohibitions. Usually they're used for people that are have some physical threat to them or threat to their property. You'll be able to get a P-spawn now if you think somebody's going to say something bad about you, hateful. And how do you define that? And then the other thing is any offense, criminal offense, federal offense that is motivated by hate will then be eligible for a sentence of life in prison. Justice Minister says, well, listen, you know, if it's a minor offense, obviously we can trust the judges to not give you life in prison just because it's motivated by hate. Perhaps. But why not? It's vaguely written in the proposed legislation. Could be made much more clear. But the main issue I have with this, right now the way it works is this. If a crime is motivated by hate, you're convicted of the crime at sentence, you then get sentenced based on who you are and what the motivation, you know, any factors like, well, it was motivated by hate, well, that's considered at sentence. This would have it considered on the front end. And so what it's going to lead to is a lot more time spent in court by prosecutors trying to prove that something was motivated by hate. And I just see the definition of hate expanding and expanding. And it's just, anyway, not the proper place to put the focus. I've talked about that before. Okay, so the Justice Minister's comments, the last thing I'll say about it, he said they were following the example of 40 jurisdictions, 40 states in the United States about putting hatred as an element of crime, in a sense, in this way. Don't know if that's really the case, but what's funny to me is the Liberals Party in particular, but many Canadian politicians, they would never compare our justice system to that of the United States and say, hey, they're doing it, so we will too. Our courts do now. Sometimes our Supreme Court of Canada will use the United States jurisprudence or others to, on some decisions, but very rarely do you see political leaders say, hey, well, they're doing it in the U.S., so it must be right, huh? So that was an interesting comment. So, all right, that's the Online Harms Act. We'll be interested to follow that through. So the minister, one more thing, was asked whether he would bifurcate the legislation and just, because the second part, the hate speech, changed the Criminal Code, Human Rights Act, part of it has been critiqued so roundly, even before it's before Parliament, why not bifurcate it, have the first part done, get it through Parliament quickly, and set aside the other part, let it be studied further, try to reach some kind of consensus, something that'll pass more easily. Well, he wasn't having any of that. It's all or nothing. He didn't say that very directly. He just said he's here to protect Canadians. Okay. Kind of infuriating when you get asked a question a couple of times, you hear somebody asked a question a couple of times and they're, just clearly not answering, which was his approach to it, but that's not unusual for this bunch. Okay, so next case. This is interesting now. This medical assistance in dying case out of Calgary. Here are the facts, as far as we know. So the case, one of the interesting parts of the case is that we don't have a lot of factual background. Person involved is a 27-year-old woman. She has autism. They're known by their initials. She's MV, and her father, WV, is the one applying for an injunction. MV, the daughter, has applied for and been granted, approved for medical assistance in dying. 27 years old, has autism, lives with her parents in the basement, has never worked, never been employed, other than a very brief stint with Elections Canada. All right. Qualified under the Alberta Medical Assistance in Dying procedure, although it was not a unanimous verdict, there was one doctor that said no, I didn't think she didn't qualify, and there was a tiebreaker employed there, so another, a third doctor brought in, approved it, so she qualifies. the father has tried to bring in evidence in the application, in the injunction application, to say, listen, you know, here's what we know of her medical situation. Yes, she is, she has capacity, she has legal capacity to make decisions. Nobody's questioning that, really, although they're indirectly questioning it, of course. She has complained of ailments, but it sounds like not really had those ailments verified medically, verified by objective measure of any kind. She, one example was, she says she can't climb upstairs, when then she was at the assessment office and she had no problem climbing upstairs and all this stuff, right? Says she's in great pain. She has trouble breathing. That seems to be one thing. She has trouble, some breathing issues. But strength was 5 out of 5. Like all, you know. But the judge says, "Well, father, this is evidence from you. This is not you know, this isn't really evidence. This is it's hearsay." Okay. Well, that's true. She, a 27-year-old woman, did not present any evidence to show why she was qualified. She didn't present any evidence in the case. She did to the doctors, and she was qualified, but she didn't present anything to the case. Her defense to the injunction application, because she is the defendant in this court case, she says, I am an autonomous person. I qualified. I made this decision. Nobody, not even my father, has the right to prevent me from doing this. And the court agreed. Court favors the autonomous decision-making of the individual. And so there was a stay on the decision. The effect was being delayed for 30 days to allow the father to appeal further and seek an injunction pending appeal. It's a tough case, though, right? Because the doctors didn't all agree. Sounds like, just sort of roughly sounds like, you know, she has... the father suggested that part of her, one of the features of her autism is that she'll get obsessed with something, and she learned about MAID and got obsessed with it. Well, that's hard to really, you know, verify or refute. So anyway, that's how this case is going to, that's how courts are going to decide these cases. Even cases like this that may sound marginal to some, may sound obviously terrible to many, that somebody with maybe mental health issues alone, hard to say, gets made at age 27. So anyway, one to watch. That'll be influential across the country. We'll see if it gets appealed up the line up to the Supreme Court of Canada. As this is being discussed further in Parliament, I'd be not surprised to see this case get a little more publicity. All right, last thing I want to talk about. Mass Casualty Commission report. We're a year later. A few articles came out and a few comments. One, well, the RCMP gave their review. They had promised by the end of the calendar year. Now they said they needed an extension. 3 months later, a year and 3 months later, they come up with this report. I don't know what they used the 3 months for. It was not much of a report. I was expecting something, you know, substantial with footnotes and, you know, like a document. This was really just like an essay on what they're doing without really verifying anything, just sort of telling us that they're doing certain things. They say a new sector in place within the RCMP called the Reform, Accountability, and Culture Sector. But this is a problem, right? So what they say about this is that this new sector within the RCMP is going to liaise with subject matter experts to determine how many or whether of the recommendations to implement. Well... excuse me, RCMP, that's what the commission was for. That's what the Mass Casualty Commission was for. It's not, you know, these weren't really meant to be suggestions. The way certainly the commissioners released them was meant to be an order. So not surprised that the RCMP would take this approach. They're now, this is really a delay, and we're going to argue back, and we, you know, this is still under discussion. They think the trial's still on. We're, they're supposed to be effectively serving their sentence at this point, and just, all right, just go to counseling. So we'll see. We'll see. What seems like to me has to happen with the RCMP in particular, I'll get to the other reports and reactions, is political intervention, the political pressure. Like, this is just further proof, I think, that the RCMP is not going to reform themselves. A few things, to their credit, that they have done. They've put the GPS software on all of the Nova Scotia police officers, they've said. Now, this had an acronym, ATAK, ATAK. They haven't used that in this release, so I don't know if this GPS software that they're using is different than that ATAK, which was supposed to be the gold standard for, you know, in the middle of a mission kind of GPS tracking. So be interested to learn more about that. They have a management advisory board, external body that gives them advice. They are making that advice public. Okay, that's something, I guess. So these are small things. They are ignoring the bigger issues of reforming contract policing and the bigger issues of RCMP, closing RCMP depot in Regina. They don't even mention, you know, they're so proud when they talk about depot. Everybody's like, oh, going to depot. Well, in this document, they don't even call it depot because they don't, let's not talk about Bruno, right? Like, they talk about alert ready training. And that they're now implementing this training at the RCMP Training Academy. So they really don't want to talk about the big stuff. So the RCMP certainly is not going to reform themselves. Be interested to know what kind. They don't talk, by the way, about what kind of alert ready training they're doing. Just that they are training on it. A couple of other things. The province of Nova Scotia gave a reaction to the RCMP report and to the, you know, a year since, sorry, to the, they not to the RCMP report directly, but just to the fact that it's been a year, and they say they've put in mental health supports up in the Colchester area, and they have issued 2,000 more trunk mobile radios to service providers. So not much from the province. Province that didn't mention this in their reaction, but the substantive thing the province has done is start a police review that Deloitte consultant firm is going to be heading up with support from a sort of broad-based oversight board or advisory board from the province. Last thing I noticed St. Mary's professor who testified actually to the Mass Casualty Commission, Blake Brown, gave a reaction just on the firearm side of things that some of the recommendations have been implemented. Freeze on the sale of handguns, but limits on semi-automatic weapon sales or magazine limits have not been implemented. There wasn't a lot of attention paid to the firearms recommendations at the time of the report, and doesn't sound like there's been a whole lot done since then either. So anyway, this is a year later, and the big, big report from the Mass Casualty Commission, and it seems if I had to sum up the three main, well, the changes that have taken place so far, not noticeable in any respect. So that's how that kind of goes, I guess. All right, we'll talk more about this probably tomorrow night with Paul Palango and Jordan Bonaparte back on the Sunday Night Show. And I missed last week's show with, see, they did it Saturday night while I was off playing hockey, but I'll be back with the boys tomorrow night. We'll talk more about that. And Paul's been sending around some interesting other articles as well, so lots to discuss. Anyway, everybody, thanks again for watching, and thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.